In fact, I was very struck by, at one, as you were, by the extent to which we were talking about a lot of relatively small-scale things, there being exceptions, but much of it. And I realized, you know, today change tends to more often come from the bottom up. I mean, if you look at how culture has changed, look at how the fashion industry now gets its cues from the street, not from big name designers. And the one area where that has happened very little is housing, I think. But it, where it has happened is in fact in some of the illegal uses that we've seen and talked about. And so the question is really, in the same way that in other realms we've kind of learned from what happens on the street, are we able, translating that knowledge in housing is a far more difficult and complex matter, but are we able to do it? Is that conceivable?
I think it's easy.
Right. Okay.
You go out to Queens and you look at garages that are occupied by mother-in-laws.
Many people think the garage is a good place for the mother-in-law, I suppose.
I think there are a set of very easy things that mm-hmm. one could do like that. Change the definition of multiple dwelling. We heard about that today. It's one easy one. Go from 2 units or less to 3 units or less. And all of a sudden, everything changes. Eliminate the prohibition of having different kinds of households and different sizes, and say in the low density neighborhoods, which are concerned about towers, which are a Manhattan phenomenon mostly, you can build whatever you want, just make it 3 stories or less.
Right.
And all of a sudden that changes. Say that you don't have to rezone a manufacturing district. You know, the thing that I'm probably proudest of voting for on the Planning Commission was to rezone 6th Avenue from manufacturing. We now have 3,000 units of housing on 6th Avenue between 24th Street and 30th Street. Maybe you don't like it, but boy, that's a lot of housing. And I think there are a number of things like that, but it means junking procedures that have been followed in this city for many decades.
Right. Do you think that if we, let's pursue that for a moment, actually, that idea. Just before lunch, Roseanne and I were talking about, or fantasizing about, a world in which, let's say, all regulation in New York suddenly disappeared, other than fire code regulation, of course, and other things related to safety, say structural rules. But all regulations in terms of usage, location, room count, anything like that, suddenly
parking.
Evaporate.
Parking.
Right, exactly. If all that stuff were gone tomorrow, could architects solve the problems?
Of course. Architects don't solve these problems. They design buildings.
Right.
Builders put these things up. What you would do instantly is make it easy for some Vietnamese contractor to come in and build something that's 3 stories high that he can market to Vietnamese immigrants. I think those are the kinds of things we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
But it means running into major interest groups in the city and terminating the monopoly that's held by big builders and big lenders.
Why do they? We know that big builders and big lenders are forces of conservatism, let's say, to use the kindest term I could think of, in this field, along with forces of regulation. I guess we can say for developers, lenders, and regulators are the forces of conservatism. But why would they continue to be if all of these regulations were lifted?
Well, they wouldn't be.
They wouldn't. Right.
The other thing that would happen are the kinds of people that in 1965 moved into former loft building in Soho.
Yeah, I mentioned that earlier as something that happened spontaneously, again, from the ground up.
And those are the things we ought to be encouraging. And it is the fastest way to change what's happening. All of a sudden, properties that don't cost a lot of money could be reused or built upon. And would change everything. In this room, I don't have to explain that simply eliminating the requirement of parking and saying you can do whatever you want would suddenly provide affordable housing developers the ability to put stuff up in on properties they can afford to buy. But I'll tell you further that there will be other places where there are developers who build luxury housing who would say, well, I can rent this parking space for a lot of money. I'm going to build more than 10% or 20%. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's something the marketplace could determine. And with computers and laptop-based businesses that have sprung up everywhere and the kind of globalization in which we have an asset in the city of immigrants that would be doing things, we would see unusual things.
How adaptable, again, let's stay in this fantasy world of non-regulated other than human physical safety, but non-regulated in other ways, buildings in New York City. How adaptable is our existing housing stock to new models?
Why don't you change the question and ask about our building stock?
Well, you can respond in a broader way then, fine. Okay.
How many Class C office buildings are there in Brooklyn and in the Bronx, or manufacturing plants? Some of you in this room know that in 1975 I led the charge to make J51 eligible for something other than rent-controlled apartments. Mm-hmm. The story was a huge change, not just in Tribeca and Soho, in legalizing and making safe buildings that could not be insured and could not be financed. All of a sudden, you would open the floodgates of lending mm-hmm. because you could convert these buildings relatively inexpensively. As for the existing stock, Geraldine mentioned households of one person living in 2 and 3 bedroom apartments that cannot afford to move. If we could free up enough additional stock that the prices would even out, you would find mobility. We are the exception in the United States. In the rest of the United States, 1/3 of the population rents their home. In New York City, 1/3 of the population owns its home. Well, I think you could unleash a great deal of housing supply that would be purchased by people who have money and live in public housing. Mm-hmm. That may sound shocking to you, but if you go to the Bronx and look at what the Nehemiah Project did, mm-hmm. the churches advertised on Sunday to people who lived in public housing who could come up with a down payment. And it means a wholly different way of thinking about housing than we're used to in this city. And one of the things that I think that Geraldine and CHPC has done such a remarkable job is returning to the world where we go to Europe or to Asia and learn from what's going on in the rest of the world and apply it to our own regulations, our own construction.
You know, the regulatory environment, the legal environment, the economic environment, and the ownership situation that these things yield is one part of the equation. Another thing that we've discussed today is the physical design of a unit itself and how that has evolved over time. It interests me that rarely, maybe a little bit in Ted Smith's presentation, but in general, rarely have those two realms intersected. Even people who've talked about both have talked about them as sort of separate things. Do you envision any relationship between the evolving design of housing units that we've been talking about and the economics and regulatory environment?
Well, here's where I'm going to turn everything upside down. I teach architects at Yale, and the first assignment I give every year to third semester graduate students is to design an apartment house. And invariably, 20 to 25% of them produce rooms without windows. I'm not for getting rid of regulations, where regulations provide for substance.
Yeah, like that can go into the human safety
yes.
group, I guess.
Light
yes,
and
health
air.
And light and air. Yeah.
And I think Jacob Riis.
You don't think going back to old law tenements is not where
that's
we should be?
Not
the solution? Okay,
no.
Fine.
But what I am suggesting is that we ought to relook at what the definition of light and air is. When the old law tenement was passed in 1867, we didn't have fluorescent light, we didn't have air conditioning, we didn't have electricity, we didn't have laptop computers. How far from a window do you have to be? Surely the artists who live in lofts that are 50 feet away from the window have adequate light and air.
Right.
So I think we could re-examine all of these things,
mm-hmm.
but it means putting in the room some of the wise people that are sitting in the audience today and having them start all over again.
You know, it's interesting. Another phenomenon that we have not talked about today in New York has been the conversion of high-rise, even in some cases post-war, skyscrapers downtown into housing, which was unimaginable even, I think, in the early days of J51. When we were beginning to convert, nobody could have dreamed that that would have happened. Can you talk about that a little bit and how it relates to some of the ideas?
Yes. J51 was, in fact, the model for the Giuliani administration when they introduced 421G, which was a tax exemption program mm-hmm. for conversion in lower Manhattan. What I'm not sure we did was to make all the rest of the changes that were necessary, but clearly we now have a 24-hour population in lower Manhattan, and we can use our infrastructure in a much more efficient way. I think there's a lot that can be done, but those office buildings are not only high-rise buildings with glorious Art Deco decoration in lower Manhattan, but they're small buildings in Brooklyn and the Bronx.
Right.
And they too could be converted.
Are they yielding, to get back to the issue of the design of units, are they yielding different kinds of housing units, or are they merely wonderful and socially useful ways of putting relatively conventional units into new places?
Other than the artist's lofts
right.
of 40 years ago, unfortunately, I think they are not, because we haven't changed the regulations
right.
by
right.
which you have to design. But the other problem, I would say, with the exception of what I heard about from Japan, I didn't hear anything
right.
about a new form of housing design to meet the new household. The Japanese cases, which we saw,
right.
were the only example. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot that we could learn. But I think there's a lot we could learn from going to Tribeca and looking at what happened.
Right. Because that really was generated spontaneously initially.
Yes.
And then
by very creative people.
Right. Could you imagine anything like Vicente Guillot's concept for the shared tower ever happening in New York?
Well, you have to go back to the world of the SRO and the West Side and 1950. The history of New York was that people didn't like rooming houses.
Right.
We ended up with homeless instead, as we eliminated a large number of them. I think it's possible, but under today's law, it's impossible to do. And I think there's a lot that could be done to change that. I also think that a lot of the one-family houses, the larger ones in Queens,
mm-hmm.
could be converted. It could be, and not just group homes, which would be opposed by the neighborhood. There
right.
are other things as well. But we need real creativity. And one of the things that, as a member of CHPC, that I would urge is why not put together a group of people to come up with a set of those changes? Wouldn't that be interesting to deliver in 2013 to the next mayor?
No, I think that, in other words, all right, we know what's going to happen in November, I guess.
I said the next mayor in 2013.
Oh, right.
I didn't say
of course not. In other words, like a blueprint for tax reform or anything else, a sort of set of idealized regulations or deregulations, as the case may be.
Exactly.
Yeah, great. I think we have pretty much covered the waterfront, as it were. I'm extremely glad that nobody during this whole day of remarkable presentations from around the world ever spoke of thinking out of the box. We should all be grateful for that. Though I suppose, if anything, we're really talking about thinking more into the box in a way. But anyway, thank you very much, Alex.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Okay.
Thank you.